We'll finish up the series on marriage this morning. I'm going to spend, maybe the first 15 minutes or so talking about the wives. Again, I didn't quite finish up on you ladies yet, and then get into the men. And I guess the reason I was thinking about this, why am I spending more time on the ladies? But a lot of what I talked to the ladies about was about what men should be doing when the ladies are the husband is the head of the wife and the wife should submit to the husband. Well, that means the husband should be the head and he should be the leader. And so there's a lot of things that I'm not going to address with the husbands because I basically already addressed it to the wives. And if you guys were paying attention, then you got your stripes at that time. So a couple things I want to talk about today while I'm still on the wives is that a wife's adorning should not be focused on the outward, such as the plaiting or the braiding of the hair, wearing of jewelry or fine clothing or makeup. This is part of Peter's exhortation here, and that's why I'm including it. He specifically mentions this in 1 Peter 3 when he's talking about the wives and how they should be submissive to their own husbands. And this would also go with all Christian women, not just wives. All Christian women should not be focused on, on outward things like braiding your hair, wearing jewelry, that type of thing, makeup and so on. And I will qualify that in a second. I'm not saying that you can never braid your hair, that you can never wear jewelry or makeup or put on clothing, obviously. And that's the key to it there. It talks about putting on of apparel. Well, if the other things are forbidden, then the putting on of apparel is forbidden too. And I don't think anybody would say that women should be walking around without clothes on. So anyway, if that would prove anything, it would prove way too much. 1 Peter 3 and verse 3, though. Peter says, "Whose adorning let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair or wearing of gold or of putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price." Women are supposed to be adorned in modest apparel. We read that in 1 Timothy 2, 9 through 10. And if you've ever left your homes, and if you've ever been in public, especially in a mall or anything like that, you clearly know what I'm talking about, that this is an important topic. Even with kids nowadays, it's awful. I work at that tutoring center. I kid you not, there was probably, I bet you the little girl couldn't have been more than 8, and she was wearing these Daisy Duke shorts. It was absolutely offensive. It was ridiculous. I could not stop thinking about, where are her parents? How in the world would they let her leave the house like that? Literally, the girl was like this tall. It was just absolutely offensive. It's just ridiculous. I can't say enough about it. 1 Timothy 2, 9 through 10. 1 Timothy 2, 9 through, that's 2 Timothy. That's why that didn't look right. That's Thessalonians. Hold on. All right. Like, even him who's working is after the power of Satan. I don't think that's what I'm going for. 1 Timothy 2, 9 through 10. "In like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broided hair or gold or pearls or costly array, but which becometh women professing godliness with good works." So women are supposed to be adorned in modest apparel. Now modest, when it's speaking of women, their attributes and behavior, it's governed by proprieties of the sex, decorous in manner and conduct, not forward, impudent, or lewd. You remember we read about the strange woman in Proverbs 7, and it said with a, something, an impudent face. Now I'm forgetting the other word. Anyway, with a, let me see if I can get that. Now it's going to bug me. Oh, yeah, so it doesn't say anything else. It says there in Proverbs 7:13, "So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him," that's what I was going after anyway, she's not exactly the pattern of modesty, in case you didn't know. So the definition works very well here. Not forward, impudent, or lewd, shamefast. Hence, scrupulously chaste in feeling, language, or conduct, shrinking from coarse or impure suggestion. Now, a female attire, and that's what we're really looking at here, modest apparel. A female attire, it's decent, not meretricious. Now, I don't know if anybody knows what meretricious means, but I will define that for you. But first, I'm going to define decent. Decent is becoming, suitable, appropriate, or proper to the circumstances or special requirements of the case, seemly fitting. Now, of course, the decency would be what is suitable and appropriate is, of course, defined by the Scripture and what the Scripture calls nakedness and says ought to be covered. Now, meretricious is of, pertaining to, characteristic of, or befitting a harlot, having the character of a harlot. Okay, so modest apparel is not dressing like a harlot. That's pretty simple, really, right? Harlots have a certain type of attire, which is fitting to their profession. Most professions have uniforms, and harlots, hookers, have uniforms too. They don't probably have their name on their shirt, but they still have a uniform. In Proverbs 7 and verse 10, I should have kept my finger back there as I was there a minute ago. Proverbs 7 and verse 10 says, "And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of an harlot and subtle of heart." So clearly, harlots have a certain type of clothing that they wear. They allow certain parts of their body to be exposed, which are tantalizing to men. They're selling something, so they're advertising. The women shouldn't dress like harlots and wear clothes that show their breasts and thighs, or are so tight and fitted so as to have the same effect. So cleavage and thighs should not be shown by women in public anyway. I mean, you can do whatever you want in your own house, obviously. But in public, that shouldn't be shown, nor should clothing that is so tight or fitted that really leaves nothing to the imagination. I mean, you could walk around wrapped in saran wrap and be covered, right? I mean, obviously, that's not really covered, right? Or you could walk around in spandex and have every crevice of your body shown where you're not really covering anything. I mean, technically, yeah, there's some layer of clothing between your skin and the man's eyes, but it's not really covered. That would likewise be the attire of an harlot. And, yeah, so I'm just going to be kind of blunt here, like I like to be from time to time. But if you're not selling sex, then don't dress like it. You know, if you're not in the business, then you don't want to advertise. And secondly, men love to look at boobs. So keep them covered so as not to give them an occasion to sin. And that's just a fact. I mean, I'm sure no, that wouldn't apply to anybody in this church, but men in general, I have heard, like to look at those things. So don't give them an occasion to sin. If women had any idea how men think, they wouldn't dress like they do. Or let me put it this way, if godly, Christian, righteous women had any idea how men think, they wouldn't dress like they do. Some women would want men to look at them, and they would do it on purpose because they know how men think. But a godly woman, if they understood, if you could just transplant a man's brain in a woman's body for a week, she would totally have a different outlook on life, believe me. So anyway, 1 Peter 3 and verse 3. Go back there. That verse is not forbidding, though, all types of hairstyling or makeup or jewelry or anything else. Or else, like I mentioned before, getting ahead of myself, it would also be prohibiting wearing clothing. And I just wanted to give this disclaimer so that people don't think that the pastor's saying that women can't wear makeup or can't braid their hair or something like that. 1 Peter 3 and verse 3, "Whose adorning let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair or and of wearing of gold or of putting on of apparel." So he's contrasting what you're putting on your body, on the outside of your body, with what should be on the inside. So if what you're, and I think I'm going to make that point here in just a second, but if what you're putting on the outside is not showing what is on the inside, then you're probably wrong. You know, what you should wear on the outside should be showing forth what is on the inside. So usually what somebody says or what somebody wears tells you what's going on in the heart. Out of the heart, the mouth speaketh. We read, out of the heart proceedeth all these evil things. But it's, you know, the real adorning of a woman should be that meek and quiet spirit. 1 Peter 3 and verse 4. Now, a meek spirit, when we're speaking as an adjective here, describing the spirit, it's gentle, courteous, kind. As connoting a Christian virtue, it's free from haughtiness, which is pride, or self-will, piously humble and submissive, patient and unresentful under injury and reproach, submissive and humble. So that's what a meek and quiet spirit is. It's not one that's proud and haughty. And go back to that strange woman. She's loud and stubborn. Her feet abide not in her house. She's proud and haughty. This is just the opposite. Really, if you want to do a good comparison, compare 1 Peter 3 with Proverbs 7. Those are the opposite ends of the spectrum. One is how you should be, the other is how you should not be. And a quiet spirit is free from disturbance, molestation, or annoyance, not interfered or meddled with, left in peace. And we read a lot about a brawling and a clamorous woman also in Proverbs. So the quiet spirit should not be, a woman shouldn't generally be annoying you constantly, interfering and meddling and causing strife in the house. Neither should a man for that matter. But a woman should be of a meek and quiet spirit. When you have a brawling woman, you know, like it says in Proverbs, you'd be better off to go live up in the attic than with a brawling woman in a wide house. You know, it talks about the continual, is a continual dropping. So is a contentious something to kindle strife. I'm not getting that one either. But anyway, you can imagine what it's like to have that continual dropping and how annoying that is. You know, if you got a leak in the roof or something and just drop, 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 drop. If you have a nagging wife, just drop, 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 drop. See, I'm trying to annoy you. See how annoying that is? So the nagging wife, you know, would really wear on you eventually. So women should be a meek and quiet, wives should be a meek and quiet spirit. Not somebody that's constantly annoying you. Now the harlot, on the other hand, like I mentioned, is loud and stubborn. She's completely the opposite. So young men, when you're out there looking for a woman, don't look for a woman who's dressed like a harlot, because chances are, if she's dressed like one, she probably acts like one, and she's loud and stubborn, and her feet abide not in her house, and she's going to run around on you and everything else. So don't look at the woman that's dressed like a slut and think, oh, that's one for me. That's not one for you. Stay away. I feel bad for Christian women that actually dress modestly, and I've had lots of them tell me that guys don't look at me. You know, the guys look at all the horrors and everybody that's dressed like a slut. And, you know, I feel bad for them. But I just, what I tell them and try to comfort them is, you know what? There are some good men out there left, and good men are looking for that. Good men are looking for the woman that's covered up. So you just keep doing the right thing, and God will see it and reward. I'm confident of that. Proverbs 7 and verse 11 says, she is loud and stubborn. Her feet abide not in her house. In Proverbs 9 and verse 13, it says, a foolish woman is clamorous, she is simple, and knoweth nothing. Clamorous is noisy, loud, or shouting. So that's a foolish woman. It's always shouting and screaming at you, or just a foolish person in general, a man or a woman. It's always shouting and screaming. I mean, there shouldn't be this idea, like people have this idea that it's just normal in marriage to just get in these knock down, drag out fights where everybody's screaming, and that's not the way it should. Maybe it's normal, but that's not the way it should be. I mean, that is no way to show your children what a marriage should be. I mean, if you're going to have an argument, you have an argument when your kids aren't present. They don't need to see you, especially if it's some kind of a screaming. It's one thing if you're just having a you know, an adult conversation. That's one thing. Maybe your kids can see how adults sort things out and fix problems, but this idea of screaming and everything, and that is not the way it should be. And no, I haven't witnessed that. I'm not speaking to anybody in particular or anything else. I haven't seen that, and I'm glad. You'd have heard from me already if I had. The godly women in the Old Testament were adorned virtuously, being subject to their own husbands. So it's interesting how this adorning, this being clothed in modest apparel, has to do with being subject unto your husband. 1 Peter 3 and verse 5. For after this manner in the old time, the holy women also, who trusted in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands. So these holy women back in the Old Testament, they adorned themselves like Peter's saying here. Not with all the outward adornment, but with the inward adornment of a meek and quiet spirit. That's how they clothed themselves. And Christian women today, likewise, should endeavor to do this. Read the next verse. 1 Peter 3:6, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well, and are not afraid with any amazement. And we kind of talked about that amazement and the mental stupefaction, all that stuff last time. I don't need to get into that again. Next, women should be keepers at home. 1 Timothy 2:3-5. So I'm just doing my best to give a thorough examination of marriage and of the different roles and responsibilities of both the husband and the wife. So I'm trying to do it as comprehensively as possible. Titus 2, 3 through 5. The aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becometh holiness, not false accusers, not given to wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. So they're supposed to be keepers at home. A keeper is one who has charge, care, or oversight of any person or thing, a guardian, warden, custodian. I think it's interesting that a wife is supposed to be a warden. Andrea, do you ever feel like you're running an insane asylum over there, running a prison? You're supposed to be a warden, so maybe that's why. I find that kind of interesting. They should likewise guide the house. Turn over a couple verses to the left to 1 Timothy 5 and verse 14. Paul says, I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. To guide, in the verb phrase, in the verb construction, is to act as a guide to go with or before for the purpose of leading the way, set of persons, of God, providence, and of impersonal agents such as stars, light, etc. So you ladies are the stars of your home. You're the lights of your home. You're supposed to guide the house. Now obviously this is, you're supposed to lead behind your husband, as it were. I mean, you're leading your family, you're leading the way that the house is running and all the normal household stuff, but you're not running the show as far as that goes. But you are certainly leading the household as far as all the kind of duties of the house go. The wife has a responsibility to run the affairs of the house under the authority of her husband. See, the next point got to what I was just trying to ramble through. This would include training, educating, and disciplining the children. Cooking, cleaning, doing laundry and shopping for food, clothes, etc. And keeping a financial budget, at least as much for household expenses that would be listed above. I'm not saying that the woman should be running the entire budget or anything and doing all the financing. If the husband wants to delegate that authority to her, if she's good with figures and budgeting and managing, that's fine. But, I mean, that should be done under the authority and the guidance of her husband anyway. I mean, he should, you know, if the wife's going out there, and if you delegated her responsibility to take care of the finances, and all of a sudden there's a Maserati sitting out in the parking lot and everything, you probably haven't exercised the oversight over the finances as you should have. Husbands, I don't think anybody in this church has to worry about a Maserati, but anyway. But yeah, those are some of your duties, wives. And in that the husband is going to be away for 8-10 hours a day, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you're going to have to take care of on your own. Some things you can wait till the husband gets home. I mean, you can do a lot of the child disciplining yourself. If there's a real heinous crime that was committed, you know, there's always wait till your dad gets home type of thing, and oh, crap, I'm in trouble now, you know. And that's what the kids should feel like, too. I mean, they should know if they do something really bad, you wait till your dad gets home. And there's going to be hell to pay. So anyway, but a lot of that stuff you're going to be in charge of, ladies. So it's not that you're just some doormat and you have no authority, no responsibility. I mean, you have really a lot of authority when it comes to in that house. There's a lot of things that you really make sure that keep going. Now, this is a full-time job and a very important one. This is the highest calling that a woman could have. A lot of people nowadays, feminists, scorn this idea, you know, that we would keep women inside the house, you know, barefoot and naked or whatever, but pregnant and barefoot and naked, yeah. Wow, yeah. Anyway, barefoot and pregnant, that's what I was trying to say, chained to the stove, you know, whatever, that kind of nonsense. But, I mean, this is the highest calling a woman can have. I don't care what any of them say. Our modern society has turned the role of a woman on its head, expecting women to have full-time careers outside the home. Now, this leads to a lot of problems and issues, and just a few of them that I thought of here. It leads to dysfunctional families in which the children are raised or trained by strangers in daycares. You know, I mean, that's a real problem. And if you do, if your wife does have to work and you have children in a daycare or something, you better be real careful what kind of care you're sending those kids to, and make sure that they share the same kind of values that you do. And just, I mean, there are some real dirtbags out there. I mean, there have been hidden camera, you know, things done where you think you have a good babysitter and they're molesting your kids or all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's just, you got to be really, really careful with that kind of stuff. This leads to stress between the husband and wife because the few hours that they have together after work are spent trying to keep up with all the cooking and housework that were not done during the day because both people are out there working. You know, that wouldn't be a very, you know, I could see that leading to not a very harmonious relationship when both of you come home, you're both stressed out after a day of work, you're both tired, and now all the cooking, all the cleaning, all the laundry, everything else has to be done in addition to what you've done all day long. This leads to parents not having adequate time to spend with their kids, and parent-child time is replaced by TV child time. It's like, I don't have time to, we gotta get all the rest of this stuff done, we've only got a few hours before it's time to go to bed again. And here, put the kids in front of the TV, you know, let the TV babysit them for a while, and your children end up suffering too because they don't have the time with you that they should. And an unending plethora of after-school activities only exacerbates this problem. And especially people that are into public schooling, and they just, I mean, they have these kids running constantly. I mean, it's just one, you know, I don't even know the sports anymore. I don't pay any attention to it, but I'm pretty sure it starts out with baseball. And then it moves into, baseball's in the spring, right? Baseball's in the spring, and then football starts in the summer and goes into the fall, and then, I don't know what. Whatever else they're involved in, you can tell how much I'm up on school sports. But anyway, they have one sport after another, and these kids, and then they have drama and plays and band and everything else. I mean, they got the kids running, and you running 5 or 6 nights a week. And that's the way they want it. This is not happening by accident. I'm convinced they want it this way. They take the kids away now at 3 years old and put them in daycare, pre-daycare, or preschool, whatever they call it. So they get them out of the house as soon as they possibly can, and then they keep them at school as long as they possibly can. They keep them for after school programs. Then they have the sports and everything else. The parents never end up seeing the kids, and when you do see them, I mean, then you got to spend an hour or so on homework, and there's just no time for the family at all. And I really think it's intentionally done. They want to destroy the family. They want to do it. Well, I don't think we got to this point by accident either, and I think that's fairly well documented. I mean, the communists, way back when, devised, it was their plan, get women out of the household, get them in the workforce, get them, you know, separate the families, get the kids away from the parents as soon as you can. Communist Manifesto, I don't remember what number it was, but public schooling, get them in public schooling as early as possible. That's what they want to do. I'm not blasting public schooling necessarily, but that's what they're saying. I mean, that's the whole point, is to get the kids away from the parents. That's what they want to do. Let's look at the roles and responsibilities of the husband now. So you wives can breathe a sigh of relief, and well, Andrew's not close enough, and you see you start elbowing your husband now every time you hear a good point, but you can elbow him when you get home, I guess. A good wife is a blessing from God. Proverbs 18 and verse 22. Proverbs 18 and verse 22. It says, "Whoso findeth a wife, findeth a good thing, and obtaineth favor of the Lord." And also in Proverbs 19 and verse 14. So if you find a wife, you have found a good thing. It's like you found that treasure in the field. You've obtained a favor from God. He's been looking, his face is smiling upon you if he's given you a wife, especially a good one. Proverbs 19 and verse 14 says, "House and riches are the inheritance of fathers, and a prudent wife is from the Lord." That's his inheritance. That's his riches. He's your father, and that's the inheritance he's given you, is a good wife. That's quite an inheritance. It's a good blessing. It's worth more than any amount of money that your father could leave to you, that's for sure. In Proverbs 12 and verse 4. Proverbs 12 and verse 4. "A virtuous woman is a crown to her husband, but she that maketh ashamed is as rottenness in his bones." Remember how I showed you last week that a husband's the king of the house? Well, a husband's the king and his wife is his crown. A virtuous woman is a crown to her husband. She's a blessing to you guys. Now, a husband should be the head and ruler of his wife and family. as was shown in the previous section. So I'm not going to get into that, but that would be all the stuff that I was telling the wives to do. Well, that goes for your husbands. I mean, you're the other side of that coin. So all those responsibilities that she's responsible to submit to you in, you're responsible to be a leader in. So just remember all that stuff, and I'm not going to repeat it. Husbands are commanded to love their wives. See, it's interesting, the things that Paul lists here, he clearly lists because the husbands and wives have an issue with these things. You notice he doesn't say, wives, love your husbands. That's apparently something that wives really don't need instructed on all that much. That's more natural to them. But he says, wives, submit to your husbands. That's not so natural, right? And when he says, husbands, love your wives, that tells me that husbands have a problem with that from time to time, and they don't love them the way that they should. And that's why Paul, in at least two different places, and Peter, I believe, says the same thing. So Ephesians 5 and verse 25, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. To love, the verb, transitive, is to bear love to entertain a great affection or regard for, to hold dear. And I'm going to define affection and regard, and I'm going to make comments. I've listed out all the points that I want to derive from these definitions, so I'm just going to read the definitions and then make comment. Love, in the noun, is that disposition or state of feeling with regard to a person which, arising from recognition of attractive qualities, from instincts of natural relationship, or from sympathy, manifests itself in the solicitude for the welfare of the object, and usually also in delight in his or her presence and desire for his or her approval. Warm affection, attachment. Affection, as we saw, which to love, and the verb was to entertain great affection. Affection is of the mind. When you're speaking of the mind, it is an affecting or moving of the mind in any way, a mental state brought about by the influence, by any influence, an emotion or feeling. It's good disposition towards, goodwill, kind feeling, love, fondness, loving attachment. In regard, which was in the verb to love, it's to entertain with great regard. To regard is to repute, account, the noun. It's repute, account, or estimation in which anything is held. Of regard, account, estimation, importance, or value. So what I take from these definitions, a husband should have great fondness for his wife. He should be very fond of her. He should have loving feelings toward his wife. A husband should have kind and warm feelings toward his wife. A husband should hold his wife dear. She should be really important to you. She should be your most prized possession. A husband should delight in his wife's presence. You should look forward to seeing her when you get home from work and tell her that. You should look forward, if you've been away on a trip, Jason, when you were away for a week, did you look forward to seeing your wife? I'll bet you did. We should. You should delight in your wife's presence. A husband should have a high estimation of his wife and consider her very important and valuable. You should esteem her highly. You should look at her and say, wow, this is a valuable woman that God has given me. She is more valuable to me than any 401k that I could have or anything else. Highly esteem her. It's very important, husbands, that you not only feel this way towards your wives, but that you tell them that you feel this way toward them. Because it's one thing, you know, don't just say, oh, it's enough, she knows that I love her. I don't need to tell her that. She already knows it. Of course I love her. No, you need to tell her. Women need to hear that kind of thing. They don't just need to know it. They need to hear it. That's very important. And I'll bet you ladies would agree with me on that. When's the last time you told your wife you loved her? Hopefully it was less than a day ago. Hopefully it was this morning when you got up. And if it wasn't, hopefully it's whenever you leave here. Tell her often. Tell her you love her all the time. You can't tell her enough, but mean it. Don't say it with pretense, but mean it. Tell her you love her. Tell her how much you appreciate her. Husbands are to love their wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. So that's how. So we saw here the fact that husbands are supposed to love their wives. Here's how you're supposed to do it. Husbands, love your wives even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. That's how you're supposed to do it. Now Christ, he loved the church with a self-sacrificing love. Remember that? Look in there'd be plenty of verses we could look at, but look at 1 John 3 and verse 16, it would be a good one. 1 John 3:16, "Hereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren." Here perceive we the love of God. This is the love of Jesus Christ, who is God. He laid down his life for us. That's how we know that he loves us. That's a self-sacrificing love. So ought husbands to love their wives. You ought to sacrifice. Everybody knows that marriage is about sacrifice. When you get married, you're sacrificing a lot of freedom, a lot of liberty, a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of energy. You're sacrificing a lot of hopes and dreams where you could have traveled the world, or you could have done whatever you wanted. You sacrifice a lot for your wife, and you should. Husbands should put their wives' needs above their own, and wives should do the same to their husbands. So if in a marriage, if both of you are putting the needs of each other above yourself, you're going to have a good marriage. Now, if you're both putting your own needs above the needs of your spouse, you're not going to have a good marriage, especially if you're both doing it. The men ought to love their wives as their own bodies, we read there in Ephesians. Ephesians 5, 28 and 33. It says, "So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself." Well, it makes sense that if you love your wife, you love yourself, because you're one flesh. She is your body. Verse 33, "Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself." Now, all men love their own bodies. And this may seem, you may not think, no, that's not true. I don't love my body. I mean, look at me. I'm overweight, or I'm ugly, or I'm whatever. I don't like my body at all. But I will prove to you that you do love your body in just a second. But the scripture says it, so that ought to be enough to prove to you anyway. But I'll give you examples of how you love your own body. Ephesians 5, 28 and 29. "So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church." So the Bible says nobody ever hated his own flesh. Let me give you some examples. We all feed our bodies with things that taste good. How many people say, "I hate my body so much, I'm going to eat the nastiest crap I can find"? Who does that? Nobody does. Everybody wants to eat what tastes good, because they love their body. And even if you don't eat what tastes the best, you might eat what's best for you, because you want your body to be healthy. So either you're gonna please your body because you like the taste of the food, or you're gonna please your body because you're gonna make it healthy. One of the two. We bathe and perfume our bodies. You know, who says, "Oh, I just hate my body so much, I'm never gonna take a bath again, I'm just gonna walk around stinky and nasty"? I mean, who does that? Nobody does that. We all put clothes on our bodies that look and feel good. Nobody goes out there and tries to find the ugliest outfit they can that looks the stupidest on them so their body looks dumb. Nobody does that. Everybody tries to look as good as they can. You try to put clothes on your body. Nobody goes out there and clothes themselves with a leathern girdle and camel's hair like John the Baptist did. You know, they go out there and they put comfortable clothes on because you love your body. We all keep the temperature in our environments at a level which feels good. You know, who says, "You know, I just hate this flesh so much of mine, I'm going to set my thermostat at 30 degrees in my apartment and just make myself miserable"? Nobody does that. And we all buy comfortable beds to sleep in. You know, nobody sleeps on a pillow of nails or something like that, you know, just because you hate yourself so much. Everybody loves themselves. And most people, especially natural men, are lovers of their own selves. You know, that's what we're told there. It's either in Timothy or Titus that would be in the last days, that men would be lovers of their own selves. Now, men should nourish and cherish their wives. It says there in verse 29, "No man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church." So if you nourish and cherish your own flesh, you ought to nourish and cherish your wife. Now, to nourish is to promote or foster a feeling, habit, condition, state of things, etc., in or among persons. So it's, well, I'm just going to save it. I'm going to save my comments because I already wrote them out so I wouldn't forget. To cherish is to hold dear, treat with tenderness or affection, to make much of, to make too much of, pamper, pet. Now, the ladies are liking this. Pamper. I'm liking this pampering idea. To pamper, pet, to caress, fondle, to hug, to stroke or pat endearingly. And this is one thing that my mother always told me, my brother and I, whenever we got married, And she always told us to cherish your wives, make sure you make much of them. And I never forgot that. Husbands, therefore, ought to promote and foster good feelings, habits, and conditions for their wives. So that's you ought to promote that. You ought to have habits and have a condition of living that are good for your wife. Don't have habits that are destructive to her. Husbands ought to treat their wives with tenderness and affection. Remember, she's not a man, men. She's not. It'd be nice sometimes, us men think, boy, it'd be nice if women were like men. You know, you could just talk to them like men. You didn't have to be so walking on eggshells all the time, be so nice and everything. Just lay it out how it is and, you know, move on. Suck it up and drive on, right? But women aren't like men. You can't treat them like men. Husbands ought to make much of them and make them feel special and loved. You ought to make them feel special. Let them know how much you love them. Let them know that you think a lot of them and that they're very special to you. Men ought to caress and fondle and hug their wives. You know, women like this kind of stuff. I mean, women respond to touch in the same way that men respond to sight. And I'm speaking in generalities. I mean, it may not always be the case. But women like to be touched, and they like to be hugged, and they like to be embraced. And so that's something that you ought to do. And it's easy to do. I mean, I don't think it's some labor of love for some man to have to hug his wife. I mean, I never used to mind hugging mine, so I don't think I'm really, you know, laying some heavy burden and grievous to be borne upon you. Hug your wife once in a while. And so anyway, husbands should not be bitter against their wives. Once again, Paul says this because it's a problem. He says it because men have a propensity to be bitter against their wives, else he wouldn't say it. Colossians 3, in verse 19, it says, "Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them." Now, bitter, I'm going to give you the primary definition, which is the natural definition first, and then I'll give you the definition figuratively speaking here. Number one, it's one of the elementary sensations of taste proper. It's obnoxious, irritating, or unfavorable, stimulating the gustatory nerve, disagreeable to the palate, having the characteristic taste of wormwood, gentian, quinine, bitter aloes, soot, the opposite of sweet, causing the proper pain of taste. So, you know, that's a pretty good definition. I couldn't have come up with anything like that to describe a bitter taste. But everybody knows what a bitter taste in your mouth is, right? Well, don't act that way to your wife. But here, I'll give it to you in context here. It's characterized by intense animosity or virulence of feeling or action, virulent, of words or the person who utters them. It's stinging, cutting, harsh, keenly or cruelly reproachful, virulent. So, husbands, when you talk to your wives, don't talk to them with stinging and cutting and harsh language. Don't cut them down. Cut them some slack. Don't cut them down. Don't have animosity toward them. And that's something that husbands can be. And it, because women don't act like men, husbands get frustrated with them. And they get bitter towards them because they, you know, they're too emotional or whatever. Husbands should be sweet towards their wives and not harbor animosity towards them. Men should speak to their wives with soft words, not harsh ones. Kind of already said those things. In the marriage, the wife is the weaker vessel. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. And I know I've said this before. This is not a slam against you ladies. It's just the way it is. It's just the way that God made you. It's not bad. It just is. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. "Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered." So the wife is the weaker vessel. And it's pretty much an observation that anybody that has been around a while has seen, that women are generally not as strong and courageous as men. That's just the way it is. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Now, it would be wrong if a man acts like that, because a man's not supposed to be like that, but that's how God has made them. In Isaiah 19 and verse 16. Isaiah 19 and verse 16. "In that day shall Egypt be like unto women, and it shall be afraid and fear because of the shaking of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he shaketh over it." So whenever the prophet Isaiah here is speaking about Egypt being like unto women, he defines what he's saying. They'll be afraid and fear. You know, when you have men that are in an army in Egypt and they are afraid and fearful, Isaiah says they're acting like women. Jeremiah 51 and verse 30. And that's right. I mean, it's true. It's just normal for women to be like that. I mean, how many times, if you're in the house and you hear some, you know, it's the middle of the night and you hear a noise somewhere in the house. Normally speaking, it's not the woman that jumps up and says, honey, stay in bed. I'll be right back. Let me make sure everything's okay. That's not the way it works, right? It's the man that jumps up and says, stay here. I'll be back. I'm going to make sure everything's okay. Now, my grandma would be the exception to this. She's 92 years old, lived by herself for all these years. My grandpa died like 17 years ago or something. 92 years old, and a year or two ago, she's sleeping at night, and she hears this thrashing around down in the basement. I would probably be in bed with my gun just praying that he doesn't come upstairs or whatever, you know? So this thrashing around the basement, so no, she doesn't, you know, sneak to the phone and call my brother and my dad and say, hey, come over here, I think somebody's in the house. No, she gets up and walks downstairs to see what it is. I'm thinking, that's just crazy. 90-some years old, and she goes downstairs. Well, it turns out it was a dog in there thrashing around in the basement. Neighbor's dog got in there somehow. It's an old farmhouse, you know, with the old stone walls and everything down there. I think another time there was a raccoon or a porcupine down there or something. But then she goes down and finds the dog, and she feels bad for him, so she lets him upstairs because it was cold. But, yeah, I mean, that's just what I would do in the middle of the night, is go down in a dark, dreary basement, you know, when I hear a noise down there. Just like the woman's fearless. It's amazing. So anyway, where was I? Oh yeah, Jeremiah 51 and verse 30. Jeremiah 51 and verse 30. It says, the mighty men of Babylon have forborne to fight. They have remained in their holds. Their might hath failed. They became as women. They have burned her dwelling places. Her bars are broken. So here are these mighty soldiers in Babylon that forbore to fight. They became as women. They wouldn't fight. And, you know, it's pretty pitiful. Just this year, our military has made it so women can be in frontline combat in infantry or whatever, in combat positions, which is just insane. I mean, that's just totally crazy. And, you know, to say what my mom had this little boy that she used to watch, and before I get into that story, that's just stupid, and I'll tell you the reasoning of the story. So they had this machine shop, her and my stepdad, and after he died, she was liquidating it and getting rid of everything, and the shop used to be a car mechanic shop. You know the old car mechanic shop? They used to have the pits dug, and you drive over the pit. Well, so anyway, they're standing there looking at this big pit in the floor. He says, what's that? And she said, oh, the people that had the building before, they had dug this pit to use. And he just looks at it and shakes his head and says, stupid. Pretty funny. But anyway, a little comic relief for you. I thought it was funny anyway. You might not have. So men need to recognize this about their wives and not despise their wives for it, but understand that this is how God made them. Don't despise your wife. Don't be bitter against her because she's the weaker vessel and because she's not the one that you know, jumps up to fend off the guy that's breaking in your house. Don't be bitter against her because of that. Realize that that's how God made her. The wife should be honored as the weaker vessel, not be the object of her husband's frustration. To honor is high respect. It's esteem or reverence accorded to exalted worth or rank, deferential admiration or approbation, as felt or entertained in the mind of some person or thing, as rendered or shown, the expression of high estimation. So the wife ought to be honored. It said, Peter said, giving honor unto her as the weaker vessel. She ought to be held in high respect and esteem. Women are generally more emotional than men and tend to deal with problems as such. And like I said, we all, you know, men all wish that their wives weren't so emotional and they were just more rational and analytical and just, you know, you could just reason with them like you can another man. And that's just generally, some women are like that, but a lot of women aren't. Men are generally more analytical, and they want to solve problems rather than just talk about them, right? And if you haven't seen it, go on YouTube and search nail in forehead or nail in her forehead. And there's this video, and this woman, it's showing this woman, and she's sitting on the couch, and she's talking to somebody, doesn't show you who, and it's only showing part of her head, like just a, you know, kind of just a little shot. And she's like, you know, I have this, it's just this pain. It's just constant. It's unrelenting. It won't let up. I just feel this pressure, and I'm just afraid it's never going to go away. And it kind of pans around. You see there's a nail stuck in her forehead. And it goes to her husband, and he's like, well, honey, you know, there is a nail in your forehead. And I'll bet you if we took that nail out, that pain would go away. Stop trying to fix it. It's not the nail. It's got nothing to do with the nail. You always try to fix everything. You don't ever listen to what I'm trying to tell you. You never listen. Just listen. He's like, okay, I'll listen. I'll listen. She's like, I just feel this pressure. And all my sweaters are snagged. And it's just driving me crazy. I just don't know if it's ever going to end. He's like, yeah, that's really got to be hard. She's like, thank you. It was hilarious. It was absolutely hilarious. So true. It's not about the nail. So anyway, this can be frustrating for husbands and can lead to bitterness, but it must be resisted. Don't be bitter. If she's got a nail in her forehead, just put your arm around her and say it'll probably be all right. And don't even mention the nail. Husbands should dwell with their wives according to knowledge. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. So husbands ought to dwell with their wives according to knowledge. Knowledge comes from the derivation of the verb to know. It's the factor condition of knowing. The fact of knowing a thing, state, etc., in a general sense, a person, acquaintance, familiarity gained by experience. So Peter's telling you to know your wives. Husbands ought to know their wives. And that sounds like a very simple point to make. Why would I even make it? There's a lot of husbands out there that do not know their wives. They really don't. Been married to them for years and don't know a thing about them. Husbands ought to be familiar with their wives by spending lots of time talking with them and doing things with them. So spend time together. Go out on dates. I recommend that. Sometimes it's hard if you got the kids and everything, but get the kids a babysitter once in a while and just go out on a date and get away from the kids and just spend some time together like it was years ago before you had the kids and get to know your wife. You might be surprised that the kids have been such a major part of your life and everything. You may find out that, wow, I didn't even know that you were reading that book, or I didn't even know that you were doing this at work, or I didn't know anything. I don't know. I don't know what your individual situations are, but I could see that happening. You get so wrapped up in life. So go out on dates once in a while. It'll do you good. Here's a quote from Matthew Henry on this text. I thought this was good. He said, "Dwelling with the wife according to knowledge, not according to lust as brutes, not according to passion as devils, but according to knowledge, as wise and sober men who know the word of God and their own duty." I thought that was pretty good. This will facilitate the husband and wife being heirs together of the grace of life. That's what is contingent upon, or dwelling according to knowledge is contingent upon being heirs together of the grace of life. And it will also not hinder your prayers. So this tells me that if you don't dwell with your wife according to knowledge and you don't know her, it will have an effect on your prayer life. And this also shows me that husbands and wives ought to pray together. So, you know, if he says that your prayers will be hindered, well, that probably means that you ought to be praying together, too. So if you're not, you should be. If the husband's not dwelling with his wife according to knowledge and not giving honor unto her, it's easy to see how that their prayers would be hindered. You know, if you're praying together regularly and you're not giving honor to her and you don't know her and there's strife and bitterness between the two of you because you've been bitter against her because you haven't recognized that she's the weaker vessel and that she's more emotional or whatever, I can definitely see how that could hinder your prayer life, both together and individually. God's ears are open to the prayers of the righteous, but his face is against them that do evil. And Peter tells us that in just a few verses down there in verse 12. He said, "For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. So God doesn't, your sin can separate you between God. Your sin can make it so God doesn't hear your prayers. So you want to make sure that you deal with any sin in your life, and that goes not just with marriage, with anything, so that God is hearing your prayers. And sometimes abstention from sex should be done, so that you both can fast and pray while we're talking about this husband and wife praying together thing. And if you look in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 5, 1 Corinthians 7 verse 5, I think I mentioned this last time possibly, it says, defraud you not one another, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. So that would be the one time where you might want to, you know, abstain from sex for a while and give yourself to prayer. Just like when you abstain from food. I mean, you're denying yourself something pleasurable and you're, I don't know if you could call it chastening yourself, but anyway, you're denying yourself something and you're replacing that with prayer to God. And God, He likes that. I mean, He commands us that we are supposed to fast from time to time. So anyway, that would be something that husbands and wives should do once in a while. A husband's number one priority, now, of course, except for the Lord, we all understand that, should be his wife. And I made the same point about the wives. The wife's number one priority should be her husband, and the husband's number one priority should be his wife. And just over a page, probably to the right, 1 Corinthians 7:33 says, "But he that is married careth for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife." So he said before that if you're not married, you care for the things of the Lord. But if you are married, you care for the things of this world, of how you may please your wife. So your wife ought to be your number one priority, men. Your kids should come second to your wives. Your kids should not come first. Your little boy that you're hoping is going to be the baseball star or the football star or whatever, he should not be the main focus of your life. Your wife should be your main focus. Your friends, hobbies, and your career should also come second to your wives. And unfortunately, that happens all too frequently, where a man's career is above his own family. You know, and he's putting all the extra hours in at the office and everything, and going out to all the golf outings or whatever else, you know, with all the guys at the office trying to work his way up. And, you know, what's it going to profit you if you gain the whole world and lose your own family? I'm kind of paraphrasing from a scripture that Jesus used, but, you know, that's not going to help anything. A husband should provide for the sexual needs of his wife. 1 Corinthians, I made the same point about the ladies too, if you remember. 1 Corinthians 7, 3 through 5. "Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife." And we already read verse 5. Now, guys, you need to remember that you are like a microwave and she's like a crock pot, so to speak. Okay? That's important. A lot of men don't understand that. You're like a bottle rocket. She's like a Roman candle. You know? Pew, done. You know, she's still going. So anyway, you got to remember that. And I'm not going to go any further than that. You know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, well, talk to me later. She's not like you. She's not usually turned on just by the sight of you and your boxers. She needs warm-up time. You know, she's totally different than you are. You're ready to go instantly. She's not. Quickies might be all right sometimes, but for women, a lot of times the closeness in sex is just as important as the climax. So women are just, you know, they're different. Why didn't God make us the same? I don't know. I mean, it would be, I always wondered about that. Why don't women think sexually or act sexually just like men, and then, you know, it's not so much work, but that's just the way it is. I don't know. Go talk to God about it. I didn't design it. Husbands ought to praise their wives when praise is earned and due. Proverbs 31 and verse 28. Proverbs 31. And verse 28. "Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her." So husbands ought to praise their wives. To praise is to tell, proclaim, or commend the worth, excellence, or merits of, to express warm approbation of, speak highly of, to laud, extol. Men ought to praise their wives both publicly and privately when appropriate. And I'm not talking about fake praise. I'm not talking about, you know, some pretentious praise where you're just going on about how wonderful she is. And especially if you're doing it in public and saying how wonderful she is, and then at home you're cutting her down and running her down. Yeah, that's definitely the wrong answer. But legitimate praise, both publicly and privately, when it's due, you most certainly should be doing. A wife ought to foremost be praised for her godliness and fear of the Lord and her works. Proverbs 31, 29 through 31. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gates. Now, most women love to be praised and told how much they're appreciated. That is one thing that a lot of women like. And if you haven't read it, you should read Gary Chapman's book, The Five Love Languages. Anybody ever heard of it? Anybody? It's a good one. He talks about, see, and here I go. I just mentioned it, and now I'm going to try to get the five love languages and probably not get them. But they are words of affirmation, physical touch, acts of service, quality time. I at least got four. That's 80%. That's not bad. Can't remember the other one. Anyway. Yeah, don't remember. But there's five of them anyway. And what he shows in that book, and it's excellent, he was a marriage counselor, and he developed this over time, and he realized that there are these five main things that most people have at least one of them as their, some people have more than one, but everybody usually has one as their primary. And there's one particular way that you like to love or be shown love. Some people like physical touch. Some people like you to just constantly be touching them, arm around you, giving you a hug. Some people like it when you do things for them. You know, maybe some wives would love it if they came home and found the laundry done or something like that. You know, that would be a way to show them you love them. Or some wives or husbands love quality time. You know, a woman just loves for you just to spend time with her, just sit on the couch with her and watch a movie or something. Gifts was the other one. That was the fifth one. Some women like gifts. You know, they like you to bring them home a dozen roses or like you to buy them a new, you know, little ring or something like that or whatever. But the thing is, most people, chances are, since there's five of them, the chances of both of you having the same one are fairly slim. Some people are lucky enough they both have the same one. So the way that you like to be loved is the way your spouse likes to be loved. So it's just natural. I love it when people buy me gifts, so I'm going to buy everybody gifts. You know, and that makes it easy, right? I love to be touched, and she loves to be touched too, and it works out great. We just touch each other all the time. You know, but sometimes, a lot of times, it doesn't work that way. You know, maybe you're a physical touch kind of person, and she's a gifts kind of person, and she's never touching you, and you're never buying her anything, and you're both unsatisfied and unfulfilled. So if you find out what your love language is, and he shows you how to do this in that book, and find out what your spouse's love language is, then you can learn, it's like learning a language. You learn that love language, and you learn to buy her gifts, or spend quality time with her, or whatever her love language might be. So anyway, I would recommend reading that book. Even for people who have been married a long time, you may still not know what your spouse's love language is. So you never know. There may be all kinds of things waiting for you in your marriage, all kinds of bliss and happiness that you have yet to dig up. But most women, getting back to my point, most women love to be praised and told how much they're appreciated. They like to hear it. It's not just enough for you to show it. They like to hear it. You know, just simple examples. Thank her for each meal that she prepares and tell her how good it was. And if it wasn't good, come up with something that's true that you can say about it good. You know, say, I don't know what. Say, boy, that you really presented that well or something. I really like the color of that potato or, you know, whatever. That probably wouldn't be a good one. But you've probably heard that country song, The Good Stuff. Have you heard that one? And he says, eating burnt suppers the whole first year and asking for seconds to keep her from tearing up. You know, so that's the good stuff. So anyway, you know, make something up that's true. Tell her that you appreciate all that she does around the house and with the kids. Let her know that you know how hard she works, though it may not be at an outside job. You know, maybe P people look at a stay-at-home mom and say, wow, it must be nice to sit at home on the couch and eat bonbons and watch Jerry Springer all day long. You know, that's not the way it is. You let her know that I know how hard you work, and I'm thankful for how hard you work. I know of a man in another church, and some of you know him too, that praises his wife often for her good character. And to the point that other men even get sick and tired of hearing of it, and he says, you know what, I don't care, I just do it anyway. So, anyway, I thought that was pretty cool. A wife ought to be praised for her beauty in private, such as Solomon did in the Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon 4, 1 through 7. Now, it seems like culture has changed in the last 3,000 years, and if you go home tonight and tell your wife these things about how beautiful she is, I don't know if she's going to be like, oh, I feel so special. I don't know, but you might want to come up with something that, you know, maybe current parlance or something. But anyway, for Solomon 4, 1 through 7, behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks. Thy hair is as a flock of goats, and appear from Mount Gilead. That appear from Mount Gilead. Thy teeth are like a flock of sheep that are even shorn, which come up from the washing, whereof every one bear twins, and none is barren among them. Thy lips are like the thread of scarlet, or like a thread of scarlet, and thy speech is comely. Thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate within thy locks. Thy neck is like the tower of David, builded for an armory, whereon there hang a thousand bucklers, all shields of mighty men. Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins, which feed among the lilies. Until the day break and the shadows flee away, I will get me to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. Thou art all fair, my love. There is no spot in thee. So, you know, the goats and sheep and all that kind of stuff. I'm not sure. I'd probably come up with something a little different myself. But anyway, try it. Maybe she'll like it. I don't know. But anyway, praise her. Tell her how pretty she is. Women love to hear that kind of stuff. A husband should never belittle or insult his wife in front of other people, or in private, for that matter. Never cut your wife down. Never insult her, never belittle her, never make her feel stupid, especially not in front of other people. But even in private, never do that. I shouldn't even need to tell you that. I mean, that should be common knowledge. Anybody with a brain should know that. A husband should provide for his family. So this is the husband, part of the husband's duty. Like the wife's duty was to be the keeper at home and to take care of all the things around the house, the husband's duty is to provide for the family. If he doesn't do this, the Bible says he's worse than an infidel. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. But if any provide not for his own, and especially of those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. So you can know your Bible inside and out. You can be the greatest scriptorian that's ever lived. You could be able to teach Matthew Henry all kinds of things about Bible exposition. But if you don't provide for your family, you don't provide for your own, and you're sitting at home on your duff when you could be working and should be working, well, you've denied the faith and you're worse than an infidel. So you're not going to score any points with God sitting at home and studying your Bible all day long if you're not providing for the needs of your family. To provide is to equip or fit out a person, etc., with what is necessary for certain purpose. To furnish or supply with something implied. To provide or furnish with a lodging. So it goes, you know, it goes a whole lot more than just providing for a widow here. I mean, to provide for his own is to provide a lodging and to provide sustenance, to provide the needs for that family. And in the law of Moses, a husband was to provide for the needs of his wife, which included three things: food, clothing, and sex. Those were the three needs of his wife. In Exodus 21, 10 through 11. Exodus 21, 10 through 11. It says, if he take him another wife, her food, her raiment, and her duty of marriage shall he not diminish. And if he do not these three unto her, then she shall go free without money. So those are the three things that he had to provide for his wife. And he took another wife, he had to provide the same thing for her. Food, clothing, and the duty of marriage. So make sure you're doing those three things. And those three things are likewise also required under the New Testament. The husband is supposed to provide for the wife's sustenance, and the definitions of the words will bear me out here. In Ephesians 5, 28 and 29, he's supposed to nourish his wife. Ephesians 5, I think we already read that verse, but it was a few minutes ago. Somebody may have forgotten. Ephesians 5, 28 and 29, so ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth him, his wife loveth himself. For no man yet or ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. So he nourishes and cherishes his wife. To nourish is to sustain a person or living organism with food and proper nutriment. So that's part of your duties, to provide. You've heard it called the breadwinner. You're literally supposed to bring home the bread and the bacon. You're supposed to bring home the food, or at least the money, so that she can go get the food. It follows that if the scripture says that wives are to be keepers at home and to guide the house, then the husband must of necessity be out in the world working to provide a means of sustenance for the family. You know, you both can't be keepers at home. So if she's supposed to be the keeper at home, that pretty much tells you that you've got to be the one that's outside of the home providing for the needs. Jesus taught that at his second coming that women would be grinding, which would be grain or something like that, for food, and the husbands would be out in the field, right? Luke 17, 35 through 36. I mean, this is the way that society functioned for thousands of years. Luke 17, 35 through 36. Jesus said, two women should be grinding together, and one should be taken, and the other left. Two men shall be in the field, the one shall be taken, and the other left. The husband of the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31 was known in the gates while his wife was taking care of things at home. He was out there. He was a politician or a judge or something like that. He was, you know, kind of a mover and a shaker, and she was taking care of the house. Proverbs 31 and verse 23, but you know what? He couldn't have been the mover and the shaker if his wife wasn't taking care of things back at the home front. And that's largely true of a pastor's wife, too. A pastor couldn't be doing what he's doing without his wife taking care of things back at home. If he had to take care of everything around the house and all that stuff, if she wasn't doing all that she does, it would be pretty hard for him to do what he does. So she's the support of him if he has one. Proverbs 31:23 says, her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. So he's sitting in the gate. And the gate in the Bible, we think of a gate as, you know, like some barred thing, you know, that blocks access to something. And that's not how the Bible refers to it. In biblical phraseology, after Hebrew, whatever that I don't know what that abbreviation means, for gates of the city as a place of judicial assembly. So a judge or a magistrate or something like that, some type of a political position. So, you know, he was kind of a big deal, I guess, there in the city. He was not at home, but he was rather in the city among the elders of the land, and he was out there providing for his family, as I already mentioned. And lastly, husbands are also responsible for the bringing up and the nurture and admonition of their children in the Lord. In Ephesians 6 and verse 4. There may be other things, but I've probably given you enough to think about anyway. In Ephesians 6 and verse 4, it says, and ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Now, nurture is breeding, upbringing, training, education. And admonition is the action of admonishing, authoritative counsel, warning, implied reproof. So this means that the training, education, and discipline of children is primarily the responsibility of the husband and the father. And I'm going to save further comment on this until the next series, which I will start next week on child discipline and training and education. So we'll talk about that, and that'll be, in a couple weeks when I talk about the education and upbringing type of stuff. But anyway, you probably got a lot to think about, and I hope this was beneficial for you, and I hope that you take these things to heart and search the scriptures, meditate on them, and be the husbands and wives that you ought to be, and show the world a good picture of Christ and His church, which is what marriage is intended to do. Thanks for your kind and patient attention.